Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome back here on Circles of Change. It's a real pleasure right now to invite a guest here from across the country, but she's no stranger to the Southwest, as well as many circles of the arts, Janice Ian. How are you this morning, Janice?
I'm good, Zara. How are you doing?
Well, you must really be excited with the Grammy Awards coming up tomorrow, correct?
I don't know if you'd call it excitement or sort of sick-to-your-stomach butterflies.
Well, terrific. Well, let me kind of tee up our conversation for those who may not be aware of who Janice Ian is. I know you'll recognize her music as we get into further conversation. She began her mostly stellar, as she says, sometimes stormy professional life at the ripe old age of 12, and when she wrote her first song, it was published by Broadside Magazine. She went on at age 14 to write really the one that really put her on the map, Society's Child, which is also the name of her self-penned autobiography that came out in 2008, which has earned her, as this is why we're bringing her on today, a 9th Grammy nomination, competing this weekend, in fact, in a different category, that being Best Spoken Word Album, with some laudable competition, including President Bill Clinton, First Lady Michelle Obama, Rachel Maddow, and Ellen DeGeneres. And as she said in the comment, I wrote my first song at 12, was published at 13, made a record at 14, had a hit at 15, and was a has-been at 16. So there's another song we'll certainly talk about, the one at 17, which means more to you than you can't know to imagine. So this idea of circles and changes, Janice, and here you find yourself going from music to published author to now blending the two with your audiobook. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm kind of stunned by the whole thing myself. Someone from the Grammy committee told me the other day that they thought that I had set a record because it's 9 nominations in 8 completely different categories, everything from spoken word and folk music to best jazz duet. So I don't know. It's an interesting life. You know, the older I get, the more I realize that you're going to get older anyway, so why not try something new?
Well, and in fact, you often hear the word, the R word, as I call it, which does not mean retirement. It means reinvent, reimagine, or even renaissance. But for someone like you, you've been kind of in a renaissance phase, what, from age maybe 14 or 15? So we need an even broader word about R.
Well, I think that one of the great things about being an artist is that you get to reinvent yourself. In fact, you're almost expected to. And if you're lucky enough to be born with talent into the right time and the right family for your talent, then you get to do all sorts of interesting things that lead to other places. For myself, Society's Child led to, at 17, led to some success overseas. That led to some Japanese friendships that have created a whole bunch of tribute albums in Japan, and things just tend to snowball on one another, I think, when you're trying to stay on the path, if that doesn't sound too pretentious.
No, I don't think so, but the other point I would imagine is you would have never predicted that whether it was you were 15 or 25 or 35 doing all these great songs, that your path would have taken so many loops and swerves and jumps up and down, right?
Oh, my gosh. I wouldn't have predicted that I would be alive now. I mean, 60s. We all thought we'd be dead by 30. So every year it's talk to me.
Well,
you're right. I wouldn't have. It's interesting because my partner is 65 this year. We've been together 24 years.
Yeah.
And we've been talking, and she has decided to, quote, semi-retire. She went back to school in her late 40s to become an attorney. And she's now 65 and wanting to only take the cases she wants to take.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now 61, and I really want to do the shows that I want to do and the projects I want to do. And hopefully we all wind up in our 60s in a place where our health is good enough and our minds are intact enough and our finances are all right enough that we can make those kind of choices, because it's certainly a luxury.
It is, but at the same time, though, as you mentioned earlier, it's this idea of you creating your own opportunities, too. So I can imagine, for example, mm-hmm. the thought of writing your autobiography, and I know it was released in 2008, but was that a multi-year step for you to really kind of unearth archaeologically or otherwise those things that have made you who you are, and then how to portray those stories in a way to entice the reader?
Oh, sure. Sure. I had keeping journals since I was a kid, like
yeah.
writers. But going back through them, deciding what was important and what wasn't, getting some perspective on a life, you know, things that you thought were important when you were 15 or even 35 or 45, from the vantage point of 55, turn out to be maybe not so important and not even so interesting to you anymore. And to me, the parallel is when I was writing at 17, I was already 24 years old.
Okay, yeah.
So I had some distance from myself and from those problems, which meant that I could look at them through a different lens. And I think what writing an autobiography allowed me to do was to look through maybe a larger lens than I was capable of until then.
And when you went back and revisited your journals or your yearbooks or stared at all the awards and trophies and gold jackets around your albums and the like, did you surprise yourself along that way of saying, oh, I didn't even remember that one, or it didn't come to life as much
so
as
often.
It does now?
No, I had forgotten all kinds of things, and I was so grateful that my first tax person had convinced me to keep journals and diaries just for backup, and I was so grateful because I could look at nights like I spent the night that Martin Luther King was killed with Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
And there it was, you know, written in my journal that I spent that night with him. So there were a lot of things that I had vaguely remembered, but then I had thought, wow, maybe I'm making that up. That turned out to be actually true.
It did true. And it's interesting, the idea of you to write that book, your autobiography at 55, I think many people, particularly in the baby boom generation, are going through this midlife shift that maybe at one point people thought was in your 30s. Now we're all convinced it's somewhere in our 50s. That might have been even a tipping point or a pivoting point for you on a deep personal level.
Absolutely. In fact, I was talking with a friend of mine just yesterday and saying everyone I know right now is going through these enormous transitions. And we're all trying to either reinvent ourselves or find other ways to do things so that we don't feel like we're banging our heads against the wall quite so much.
Right. We did enough of that in our younger days.
It's overwhelming these days.
Right, exactly. Well, you had the fun in giving birth to that child of your autobiography, which I'm sure brought all sorts of new trap doors to fall through or open up. But then the decision here several years later to now turn it into an audiobook. And that's not just any audiobook, of course, because you've infused and connected your music throughout it. Was that something, you know, an idea that popped to you, or did someone come to you or have to convince you to do it? How did it unfold?
Well, it made sense. When I started talking with Audible, mm-hmm. and I started talking with Stephen Radnicki, the producer, and I said, you know, in the book, each chapter opens with a song quote, and there are some songs running through it as I illustrate things like the song Bette Midler Cut Some People's Lives, or mm-hmm. Society's Child, or Jesse. And I said, wouldn't it be great if we could somehow meld the two so that we don't make a record, but I can sit in the studio with a guitar in my lap and a book in front of me, and I can sing my way into the chapters and through them in a way that's not pretentious or cloying.
Mm-hmm.
So we went for making it very intimate and very natural, like I was to use a cliche, sitting in my living room singing and talking to a friend. Mm-hmm. And apparently it worked. I mean, I do think I've got the only Grammy-nominated book that actually has music to it.
Well, most certainly your own music, right? But the idea,
right,
too, it sounds like in typical Janis Ian fashion, where there are no rules, right, that you also didn't need takes or retakes of this. You went start to finish with probably some coffee breaks in there, and just enjoyed the spontaneity of it.
Yeah, that was one of the great things about working with Stefan, was that he trusted me because he had never done anything like this with music before either. And I just said, you know, the worst that can happen is that it will be dreadful and we'll have to give back some money and it'll never happen. But the best thing that can happen is it will feel very real and very organic. And he trusted me enough to let me just run with it.
And, you know, isn't that really some of the beauty in the creative space, is when you sometimes get the best work when you don't know what you don't know, so you just go do it.
That's exactly right. And you stop worrying about doing it right or doing it wrong. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big thing. You know, people from my generation grew up in a world where you have to be right-handed at school, and there was a correct way to make an A and a B and an incorrect way. And it's a very different world now, and it's hard sometimes to let go of that struggle for a perfection that really doesn't exist and is boring when you get close to it.
Yeah, well said. Janis, of course, Society's Child, that being that wonderful first song that you wrote, and, you know, the challenges you went through in breaking through with that song at your age, at the time, in fact. And, in fact, my producer here mentioned that the song was on the top of the Ann Arbor charts in 1966. So that was even before it made it big nationwide, shall we say. So this whole idea of really being ahead of your time back then, but also in other things you've done over the years, is that kind of mantra or that space, is that
no,
where you feel you've been?
Accident. No, it's really honestly an accident.
I mean, accident, no.
I went up with my own website around 1989, and that was completely by accident. I had some friends who were fooling around with it. I was, I guess, a lead in the protest song movement, but that was by accident, too. It was not intentional. It's when I was writing the book and then reading it, at one point, Stefan looked at me and he said, "Boy, you're like Zelig, aren't you?" Kind of popping up wherever there's something controversial and winding up on the correct side. I wish I could do that with stocks and bonds.
Well, you know, maybe not then. Wouldn't keep you hungry doing this wild stuff that you continue to do. Well, the fact that your audiobook is out, and obviously this weekend, tomorrow, in fact, we're going to find out where we come out in all the Grammy nomination categories and the like.
Oh,
do you feel it's because of that, well, you say this anxiety around you, but are you anticipating or any idea where it's going to take you now that you've done it?
No, not a clue. No. Not a clue. Honestly, I mean, I'm already involved in other projects, to the point where I said to my partner, you know, it's not that I'm knocking a Grammy nomination. It's astounding. I would never have dreamed at 61 to get another nomination. But on the other hand, it's taking away my time from other projects.
Yeah, this annoying notoriety stuff.
I know.
Really.
That's why I said I do not mean to be making light of it or anything. I'm really, really grateful for it. It's astonishing. But on the other hand, like everybody else in the world, you know, my life goes day to day, and I try to keep to my schedules and get things done. And when there's a wrench in the works like this, it's a huge wrench.
Well, of course, you know, you are a two-time Grammy Award winner, as well as this is your ninth nomination. So it's not like this is the first time for you. But in some regards, it is, because it's of this unique and different format, and it catches you at a different phase of your life as well.
That's very true. And it's also, it never gets old.
Right.
You know, to have the respect of your peers, especially in that category with those people, I mean, that's pretty extraordinary. And that part, it doesn't matter, I don't care how many awards you have, something like this is really meaningful.
It is, and the recognition of your peers. For those who just tuned in, we're speaking with Janis Ian with today. What a special opportunity to interview her the day before the Grammy Awards. And you can visit and learn more about her background and her offerings at janisian.com. And out there, of course, you can download some excerpts from her book, Society's Child, an autobiography, that as well, not just the written word, but now is in the spoken word. Janice, also in this phase of your life, I noticed here in the timeline, which is wonderful, you can find out, you know, anyone who's got their timeline plotted out there, you know, there's a lot of good stuff to capitalize on here for an interview, that you were the first. So in other words, you know, you can run, but you can't hide. You put it all out there for us. Janice, you were the first musical guest on the very first episode of Saturday Night Live, 1975. I'll date myself. I was just starting college, and it was absolutely a must-see every Saturday night. What was that like for you, that experience back then? Do you recall it vividly?
Oh, sure. Several things about it. First of all, I had strep throat and 104-degree fever, so I kind of limped through the day. But I also remember that it was the first live entertainment show since the Sullivan Show had gone off the air. So everyone was pretty much terrified. The cast was terrified. The camera crew was terrified. And I think that's one of the reasons why they had me and Billy Preston on, because they knew that we were used to performing live in Europe on TV, so we weren't going to flub our lines. The whole thing went off without a hitch, and boy, by the next week, the whole thing exploded.
Yeah. And isn't it funny? It was as if there was this rubber band on a propeller that was being tightened and tightened and tightened, and somebody lifted the brake and went zing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great description.
Well, then in 1992, I see here, so this is 20 years ago, started your own record album, Rude Girls. I love it.
And I did.
I'm assuming that a lot of these projects you alluded to that are kind of in the way with this Grammy thing for a while, a lot of your energy is then into your music, of course, now.
Absolutely. And I've got a book project with a song I wrote called The Tiny Mouse.
Oh.
It's coming out in September. Here in Europe, and it'll be an illustrated children's book about a little mouse who goes off to sea and finds himself getting horribly seasick and spits up 7 oysters and a clam when he gets back. So I'm working on that. I'm in the middle of a children's album project and my own next album project, and then I'm working on a couple of young adult novels. So, yeah, and then I'm leaving on tour March 1st.
Well, it's interesting you've turned to children's books and then young adult books. Tell us a little bit more about that. I suspect that's part of you're living a legacy for the generations coming up.
Well, yeah, I don't really look at it like that. It's funny, the older I get, the more often I get people updating their obituary columns and saying, how do you want to be remembered? And really, I don't care. But the children's thing came out very generically. I was asked to do a project by Dame Cleo Lane in the UK for a little boat that was going to go down the Thames as part of the Olympics. And she wanted a song about a little mouse that went to sea, so I wrote it. And then I had such fun singing it that I thought, oh, what else could I do? And I showed it to a friend of mine who knew some publishers.
Right.
And one of them just jumped at it and got this great couple of illustrators called the Schuberts to do the illustrations. I've just seen the first ones, and he's a very European-looking mouse with a nice big mustache.
I love it, yes.
And then I went into the studio and made kind of a Fantasia meets The King and I record of it. And so we started putting that together, and as we were putting it together, I realized I had so much fun writing the song and making up things that had nothing to do with reality, that it would be fun to make an album of just songs like that. And
right.
Then it became very logical to do an album of lullabies for grown-ups or children's songs for adults or something like that. I don't have a title at this point, but it is a fun project to be working on.
Well, and you know that this aura of mixing the generations at the same time and the media, and you're right, lullabies for adults, Lord knows we all need them. I certainly could use a few
get
me to sleep, right?
Yeah, there you go, especially as you get older. Boy, it was funny. I was writing with Bette Midler a few months ago, and one of the things that came up was, as you get older, how hard it is to get a decent night's sleep and how annoying it is when you lay there thinking, I really do want to be asleep right now, you know?
Right. And so that's when the other side of you is saying, well, as long as I'm here, I might as well get back to work. And those in the creative space, I bet you wake up with the lyrics for your next 4 songs automatically. Janice, I know your work not only spans the literary field, as we've talked, in music, but also in the philanthropy. And tell us a bit about the Pearl Foundation, named after your mother.
Oh, how nice of you to ask. My mom came from that generation of women that never got to go to college, and she always dreamed of it. And she was stricken with multiple sclerosis when I was in my 20s, and it became very apparent that she wouldn't be able to continue working. So I sent her to school, to a school where she'd only have to be on campus once a year.
Wonderful.
And over 14 years, she graduated. And it was one of the proudest things of her life that she had a college degree. And when she died, we formed the Pearl Foundation, named after my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is raise money through these special living room concerts. For instance, Judy Dance, who lives in your area, held a living room concert, and 100% of the proceeds went to this foundation.
Wonderful.
My website has things scattered through it, like make us an offer, come be a roadie for a day.
Mm-hmm.
All my merchandise profit goes to the foundation. And as of March of this year, we will have given away $700,000 in scholarships for older students who want to go back to school.
That's just fabulous.
So we're very proud of that.
Oh, indeed, and every reason to be. So, Janice, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for sharing some of your time today. A best of joy and excitement for the Grammys and nomination and the award that's going to play out tomorrow. We'll continue to watch this.
Good thoughts.
All the way. You can count on us from Tucson cheering you along. But, you know,
Absolutely.
It goes without saying that you're really one who is continuing to go from success to significance. And thanks for that kind of inspiration for all of us out here. A real pleasure to have
Thank
you on the
you
show
so
today.
Much. What a lovely way to put it. Thank you.
You got it. And again, for our listeners, you want to go to Janice, J-A-N-I-S-I-A-N, JaniceIan.com to learn about her various genres of music as well as the latest audiobook. Download a variety of things to take a look at. And by the way, we love your kicking cowboy boots that you've got on there today.
Thank you. They can be yours for $1 million donation.
All right. Oh, I'm going to work on that. Okay. Take care.
There you go. Thank
All
you
the
again,
best.
Sarah.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
I learned the truth at 17, that love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear skin smiles who married young and then retired. The Valentines I never knew, the Friday night charades of youth were spent on one more beautiful. At 17 I learned the truth. And those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.